Nobody does it better than Regent Seven Seas Cruises. Enjoy all-inclusive, unrivaled luxury with unlimited shore excursions, indulgent cuisine, personalized service, and more aboard spacious all-suite ships. Visit rssc.com to experience the unrivaled.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I am delighted to welcome Ian Basson, who is the founder and executive director of Protect Democracy, also a former associate White House counsel in the Obama administration, and MacArthur Fellow, also known as a Genius Grant recipient, and a friend of mine. So, Ian, thank you so much for being here. There's so many things I want to get to.
It's good to be back on the show, Mona. I know we've been trying to figure out how to get back together for a little while. I'm glad we're doing it right now, because this is the moment where we need to talk about what's going on right now.
We sure do. So we meet on the day that NATO is being murdered, arguably, and our whole international order is sort of transforming. I don't know if you saw yet the speech by Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, but he was very blunt and said, he was quoting Václav Havel's famous speech about not putting the sign in the window anymore, where you refuse to go along with a lie. And the lie that the Canadian Prime Minister said they can no longer pretend to believe in is that the United States is the head of the free world, is part of and the leader of the free world. Kind of a tough moment, but it is truth. And so it's always better to be truthful than to live a lie, right?
Yeah. And, I listened to the speech this morning and, he had a line in it where he said, this is not a transformation, it's a rupture. And, I thought that was a helpful frame for, because I had been thinking up until I heard him say that it's a transformational moment, an extremely dangerous one, one that will have enormous costs, unfortunately, probably all in blood and lives, but that it was a transformation. And I think by rupture, I think he sort of calls to the mat the question for everybody at Davos and around the world, which is, the world that we have known has ended. And I think that we all don't really know quite what comes next. And the characters who have been ascendant in this moment are those who are holding the knives, to your point about NATO being murdered, committed to killing the world that existed. Donald Trump, the figure with the knife proverbially in his hands, but they don't have a vision for what comes next. They are destroyers, not builders. And so I thought it was helpful to have Carney say this is a rupture. And I thought Gavin Newsom, who also in Davos excoriated, just like Carney did, the institutional leaders, politicians, corporate leaders for saying, and Newsom used some pretty colorful language, that they have just capitulated on their duties. And I think the combination of what Newsom was saying, what Carney was saying, is a call to the leaders and to all of us. We better quickly figure out how to build what comes next, because the Trumps of the world are just destroying. And the future is in the hands of those who will build. And it's not a transformation, because we don't yet know what's on the other side. We don't have a plan for it. It's a rupture, and it's up to us to build what's on the other side. And in that way, I thought Carney's was a call to arms to all of us, right, to build what needs to come.
Yes, although it is really difficult to see our way clear to what that is, because Carney spoke about nations that believe in the rule of law, that believe that sovereignty matters, that believe that you don't cross borders willy-nilly just because an aggressor who has more power wants to, that there should be rules of the game. those are all things that we used to believe and we used to uphold. And so when we speak in terms of, well, we cannot go back, people are always saying this, well, we can't go back because that's all over now. Well, if that's over, then we're talking about a really fierce and dangerous world. And I don't think anybody wants to go forward into a world without, for example, respect for the rule of law and sovereignty. So I am somebody who says, well, there are certain ways in which we need to go back.
I fault myself and, you know, organizations like the one that I lead, Protect Democracy. And I think, you know, the sort of democracy ecosystem that you and I have been a part of for the last decade or so, with making one major, I think, political mistake, which is that the world was deeply dissatisfied with where the largely successful, I think, 20th century experiment had taken us. The 20th century experiment of liberal democracy, both domestically in advanced societies, and the post-war rules-based order globally, were largely remarkably effective, kind of wildly effective, both in terms of global peace by historic comparisons, global prosperity and innovation. And Carney acknowledges all of this in what he was saying, that the deal worked for everybody. The Pax Americana, even if it had its hypocrisies and imperfections, it worked so well for everyone that everyone just lived with its imperfections, on a broad level, while we tried to sort of tinker at the edges to improve them. But it had, I think, you know, now in hindsight, with the 2008 financial collapse, it had run its course in a certain way, which is it had reached certain extremes, especially on the sort of free market neoliberal front, that the broad public started to feel that they were getting a raw deal. I remember I was in the White House in 2010. The political office was doing a whole bunch of polling in advance of the midterms. And the one core message that was coming back from the polling was that post-financial crisis, the fundamental bargain at the heart of the American democratic experiment, and I think the global liberal democratic order, which was if you work hard and play by the rules, you can get ahead and build a stable life for your family. And that was the deal. And that the financial crisis basically called the lie on that deal, and that people woke up to realize that those who had cheated at the rules actually had greatly benefited and were not held accountable. And those who had played by the rules and tried to wait their turn in line and work hard were the ones who were left holding the bag. And that fundamental betrayal of the deal caused the public to turn on the broad liberal democratic order, and especially the sort of neoliberal order of the late 20th century. And I think that we, in initially arguing after Trump's election that, hold on, we got to protect the institutions and the norms, the status quo, wildly misread the public mood in a way that Trump didn't. They didn't want to hold on to the institutions of the status quo. They felt betrayed by the institutions of the status quo. And I think we need to recognize that, certainly as a political matter and probably as a philosophical and intellectual matter, not only can we not go back to the late 20th century order, that is not an attractive political proposition or winning political proposition anywhere in the advanced democratic world, even if, and this is where I think the turn is key and where you and I probably will land and concentrate, even if we have to take some of the core values that underpin the liberal democratic order and carry them forward into something that will look different. And this is where I think Carney started to plant the flag of what comes next, which is he said we're in a rupture, and he said what's going to come next. And he had a whole bunch we could talk about what was in it. But he said the thing that the middle powers need to unite and hold on to are the values that animated the liberal democratic order, even if we need to carry them forward into a great powers era that is going to look and feel different. And that's the thing that I think we got to hold on to, even if we're not going to go back to 90s era liberal democracy.
Very interesting. I partially disagree. So let's talk about this.
Yeah, that's what the podcast has historically been called, right?
Well, my old podcast was called Beg to Differ, and this one is just, yeah.
Well, I'm just anyway, carrying forward yeah. that legacy. We're I'm going carrying back, forward I'm going the back legacy. To it.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So I do agree that certain institutions in American society failed pretty badly in the late 20th and into the 21st century. I just think it's different institutions. Now, speaking of the financial crisis, it is true that by protecting people's bad bets and giving bailing out companies that made bad bets with taxpayer money, we did the exact opposite of what capitalism is supposed to be, which is, you know, we privatized the benefits and socialized the losses, you know, privatized the profits and socialized the losses. So that was really bad. But it was something that we also did for a lot of sort of small, we did it for the big, you know, banks and big financial institutions, but we also did it for a lot of people who, you know, were trying to flip homes and make a quick buck. It wasn't always the big guys were evil and the little guys were virtuous. Some of the little guys were also not so virtuous, but we bailed out a lot of people. And that's always a bad idea. And I think that should be the lesson that we take from the financial crisis is don't backstop, you know, make sure that people have skin in the game. Make sure that these companies, if they're going to be making wild loans that are, you know, make these, you know, huge leverages where they can't cover themselves, that they and their shareholders bear the brunt and not the U.S. taxpayers. That's just me. I think that's should have been the better lesson of the financial crisis. Not that the whole system is rigged against the average American, because I don't really see it that way. But now I'm going to get to the other part where I think it's interesting that the institutions that I think really failed get no attention. They haven't generated the kind of anger that we see against, I don't know, the media and business and other things. But that's the education system, which has so badly failed the poor and those who come from, you know, backgrounds where they don't come from enriched homes and they rely really pretty heavily on getting a good public education. And they're not reading at grade level. I mean, the numbers of the statistics are appalling about how we're educating our kids. And yet, so there's an institution that I think has failed terribly, and we don't pay a lot of attention to that. Your thoughts?
I mean, I can't argue, can't beg to differ with that. I mean, we might, you know, the two of us might arrive at different assessments as to what caused or drove that failure. And honestly, I don't purport to have the absolute answer on that. But, you know, I live in California. The Prop 13 cap on taxation in California has had a really deleterious impact on the public school system in California, where, you know, for the public school system here, anything outside of the bare bones core curriculum of, you know, math and literacy is paid for by the PTA in one of the wealthiest states in the union and one of the wealthiest geographies in the world. So we have been starving our public resources of the resources they need, especially on things like education, to solve that problem. That's not the only problem, but, you know, it is the beginning of how you would start to pay school teachers what their value is in society. If you don't have the budget to do that, it's very hard to do that. And I just also don't think that we as a country have had the political will to pay school teachers what school teachers need to be paid, if given how much of sort of civilization rests on their shoulders. So yeah. I agree with you completely that it's one of the many institutions that have failed us in the late 20th and early 21st centuries.
Well, now that the weather is super chilly and it is really cold here where I live, it's good time to talk about Quince As you know, I love their cashmere sweaters, which are just delicious in this kind of weather, and I find myself reaching for them over and over again. Quince's clothes are designed for layering and mixing, and each piece helps build a timeless wardrobe made to last. With versatile silhouettes and thoughtful details, they're the kind of styles you wear again and again. I do. They've got wardrobe staples with quality that's made to last. 100% organic cotton sweaters, premium denim made with stretch for all-day comfort, Luke's cotton cashmere blends perfect for the changing season, and then, of course, my favorite, the fully cashmere sweaters for this time of year when it's freezing. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen so you're not paying for brand markup. Just high-quality clothing. They use the highest quality materials like 100% European linen and organic cotton. I am loving my cashmere sweaters, which in all honesty, all right, full confession, I did get three. Because honestly, the prices are lower than you would find in department stores or other online retailers. So it's really quite a bargain and the quality is great. Plus, they give you instructions on how to keep your sweaters looking great. I have to admit that before I started buying from Quince, I used to take my cashmere sweaters to the dry cleaner, but they give you a little card that tells you how to take care of it. And it turns out that washing it by hand is actually better for the sweater. So it will last longer. And it also smells a lot better when you're done than the dry cleaning, harsh chemical smell. So refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's Quince, quince.com/Mona to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/Mona. Okay, now looking back, not to the last century, or half of a century, but just to the period of Trump. In 2016, I think you changed your life. I know I changed my life to try to address what we saw happening to the country, try to respond. I heard you on a podcast with another friend of ours, Yasha Monk, and you were talking about the things you did right, the things you think may have gotten wrong. And one of them was, that relying on a litigation strategy. So I wonder if you could talk about that for a minute, because I want to get to what Protect Democracy is actually doing and what it's doing differently now from when you first launched it and why.
Yeah. I mean, so when we first launched Protect Democracy, I came out of the White House counsel's office. My co-founders came out of the White House counsel's office. So, we were lawyers. We had hammers and everything looked like nails. But we all, we also, I think, looked at the system that the founders built and said, well, they fundamentally designed the Constitution as a check against tyranny. That was the animating motivation of the Constitutional Convention, and the framing era was a response to King George, and the lessons of human history that power will seek to aggrandize itself and to create a set of overlapping checking institutions as a guard against tyranny. That was the project. That is the project. And yes. So with the election of someone who I think you and I and many others clear-sightedly in 2016 saw for what he was. And I lament how many people took so long to see it, and some still don't see it. But I think we saw very early, this was fundamentally the character that the founders were worried about. And therefore, we should animate the system that they gave us to do what they designed it to do, right? Because the Constitution is not a self-enforcing mechanism. It's just words on paper. So if a tyrant comes to power, it's not like the parchment jumps up, starts dancing around and doing things. No, right? The document gives us as citizens a set of tools that we can use or not use to guard against tyranny, but we had to use them. And so, you know, a primary one, obviously, was using the court system and the judiciary. And so we did a lot of litigation in the early days of Protect Democracy to provide a check against an executive that was trying to override the limits on executive power that have been there for a good reason. And I think, you know, we had a lot of successes in the early years. And I think, along with many of our partners in the ecosystem, you know, did put speed bumps in the way of Trump's attempt to consolidate power in his first term, so much so that he was legitimately turned out of office through a free and fair election. I think the first big error we made a lot of errors. The first big error we made was that after Trump left office the first time, we expected there might be sort of a post-Nixon moment, a 1970s stretch like happened from 74 to 79, where you had a bipartisan set of reforms looking at what had happened and trying to prevent that from happening again. So right in the 70s, you have the Federal Election Campaign Act, the Privacy Act, the Ethics in Government Act, the Church Commission. There's a whole bunch of bipartisan work to learn from and correct for what went wrong during the Nixon era. And we put a lot of chips on the table that might happen, building legislative packages like the Protecting Our Democracy Act that were designed to say, hey, we got to reinforce some of these guardrails because Trump exposed them as weak. We got to strengthen them in case a future tyrant comes along and tries to do the same thing. And that project largely failed. There were a few things that we managed to get through, some of them that have become relevant in the second Trump term. But for the most part, that bipartisan consensus never formed in the post-Trump era. And then when Trump came back into power, you know, I think my first reaction was, you know, well, don't try the same thing expecting different results, which is that since he was back in power, clearly all the stuff that we'd done up to that point hadn't been successful enough. So let's not go for the same litigation strategies. And so we did do some litigating. We have done litigating during the second Trump term, but I really tried to pivot us to viewing the problem as less a legal one and more a political one. And what I told Yasha, you know, when we were talking on his podcast the other day is, I think there was a bit of a miscalculation in that the litigation strategy in Trump 2 has been more effective than I thought it was going to be. I worried that the lower courts would do a lot of checking initially, and then the Supreme Court would eviscerate all of those. And while that has happened to some extent, the lower court wins have been material in slowing some of Trump's efforts down. Just this week, we saw his attempt to install Lindsey Halligan as the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia because she was the only one who would carry out his weaponization agenda and go and indict Tish James and Jim Comey when there was no basis for doing so. We saw it fail because the lower court judges in the Eastern District of Virginia, including one appointed by Trump himself, said no. And she has been forced out of her position. And even though the Supreme Court has been woefully disappointing in this era, they also did, you know, at least stop Trump from deploying the National Guard in Chicago, Portland, Los Angeles. And as of the day that we're recording this, they heard arguments in the Lisa Cook case. And it certainly looks like they are not going to go along with Trump's attempt to take over total control of the Federal Reserve. So the court strategy has been more successful in Trump's second term than I think I initially thought it would be.
Just as a matter of, you know, full confessions, I will say that I devoted a lot of column space and podcasting effort during the Biden years trying to get the Electoral Count Act reform passed. And looking back now, that was good, but I really wish we had devoted all of that effort to repealing the Insurrection Act instead, if we had had a little bit more foresight, that was really a much more serious dagger that is in the possession of the executive. And anyway.
Well, but if it makes you feel any better, you know, Protect Democracy, we were in the weeds on the Hill on both the Electoral Count Reform Act, having participated in sort of drafting the blueprint for what ultimately got passed into law and working with the bipartisan group of senators on passing it, but also in trying to rebalance power between the executive and the legislature on things like the Insurrection Act, on things like emergency powers, on things like war powers, working with a bipartisan group of senators on this, a tripartisan group, if you include Bernie Sanders. And it just wasn't impossible. The Republican Party just was not willing enough to go along with most of it. And we even had some resistance from the Democratic Party at moments during the Biden administration when they didn't want to relinquish the president's emergency powers. And so I want to make you feel better that I don't think it was necessarily for lack of effort that we didn't get some of those other reforms through. The Electoral Count Reform Act was, politics is the art of the possible, and it was the thing that was possible. And that other stuff, I think, in the ways that, as I was just saying, in the ways that the bipartisan coalition never came together meaningfully in the interval between Trump's first and second term, it made it impossible to do reforms like that.
Yeah. And then in some fantasized future, I think if we were going to be serious about correcting some of the mistakes that the founders made, and you referred to the fact that they were attempting to thwart tyranny, which I completely agree with, maximum amount of liberty and thwarting tyranny, we would have to amend the Constitution if we ever could get to that point to eliminate or vastly scale back the pardon power.
Absolutely. This is what these autocrats around the world do, which is they look at the existing legal landscape or constitutional landscape for powers that they legitimately have, but that by practice and norm have been exercised by every prior occupant of the office with a degree of restraint. Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt write about this in How Democracies Die, that mutual toleration and restraint are the sort of central ingredients in functioning liberal democracies. And you don't use every single power you could possibly use under the letter of the law, because doing so would destroy the spirit of the system. And we have now seen what happens when someone comes to power and tries to do that. And so I agree with you. There's a whole bunch we would reform, I think, constitutionally, given what Trump has exposed as the deficiencies of the anti-tyranny check that the founders built. That's obviously because of how challenging and difficult and the high hurdles of constitutional amendments, very difficult to imagine doing in the short term. But Mona, we shouldn't leave people feeling despairing about this, because there's a lot of good stuff that is happening that can be done, right? And so one, on the litigation front, it has been more successful, as I noted, than I think we anticipated it being. We litigated in Chicago when CBP and ICE deployed there. And the judge in our case, now in an opinion that is being quoted over and over again every day, found that the abuses that the federal officials were engaging in residential communities in Chicago, I mean, we're talking about throwing tear gas in residential streets little kids were getting ready to go on Halloween parades, called it all as shocking the conscience. And when Judge Ellis hauled federal officials in, including the head of CBP, Greg Bovino, in the area to testify, they, according to the judge's opinion, flat out lied to the court. Yeah. And now the ACLU local chapter in Minnesota filed a similar case in December. They just got an excellent opinion in that case that sort of tracks very much a lot of the stuff that we litigated in the Chicago case. We're now seeing government officials in both Illinois and Minnesota come in on the backs of those cases to put a check on this. We are also now seeing a lot of energy, and this is one of the other ways that the founders sort of designed an anti-tyrannical check in the system, is not just through the checks and balances at the executive level, but in the federalist design, obviously.
Exactly.
The breakdown in power between the states and the federal government. And so we have been working across the country on building state statutes by which residents could hold federal officials accountable for violating their constitutional rights. Because right now there's a gap in the legal accountability landscape where if you or I have our constitutional rights violated by a state government official or a local government official, we can sue them for damages under federal law. But if our rights are violated by a federal official, right now our path to achieve some remedy there is extremely limited, if existent at all, which is a wild gap in accountability.
And the states could give that right of action?
They could. So states could pass laws, what are called universal or converse 1983 laws. And we've drafted model legislation of such laws that has now been introduced in New York and California. Governor Hochul, in her State of the State address, made it a priority to pass the law in New York. Senator Wiener is the introducing senator in California, where it is now. It just cleared the committee in the California Senate on an 8-2 vote. And now, after what had the tragedy, the killing of Renee Good in Minnesota, we now have a whole bunch of other states, Minnesota, Virginia, Maryland, that are interested in passing similar statutes. And this is what the founders had in mind, that not only would we have tripartite system of government at the federal level, where the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive would serve as checks on each other, but the fundamental sovereignty would rest in states, and they would also serve as another layer of check on abuse. And so maybe if we're going to try to look at this moment through slightly rosier glasses, which is really hard to do right now, it is that maybe we are living in an era in which we are being reminded of the importance of the constitutional structure that was laid out and our job as citizens to make sure it is animated and active and vital, and that what we will come out of this era with is a renewed commitment to civic engagement and to animating the aspects of our system that did make us the most successful free society in the history of human civilization. And we just needed a wake-up call to make it even stronger.
So one of the things that gave me a boost psychologically last year was that, if you recall, I mean, after the awful murder of Charlie Kirk, there was a sense that the MAGA forces were going to attempt to use that murder as a way to discredit anybody who criticized the president, anybody who was insufficiently respectful of the memory of Charlie Kirk. I mean, you couldn't even so much as say online that, you know, he had defended guns and so forth. And, you know, anything was getting people fired. So you had this sense of a kind of, you know, reign of terror that was going to descend. And they were threatening to, you know, examine the left-wing organizations and possibly pull their tax exemption, on and on and on. But then sort of, I don't remember the exact time frame of, I guess that was in the summer. And then in the fall, we had the No Kings rallies. And the No Kings, before the No Kings rallies happened, you had Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, you had all of the, J.D. Vance, probably Trump too, I don't remember, saying this is Antifa. These people are going to be, you know, violent, you know, insurrectionists are going to be out. They should know about insurrectionists. But anyway, and I wasn't sure how it was going to go. I thought, you know, there could be elements that are going to be violent. And if there are, we're going to see the Insurrection Act. We're going to see, you know, major troops being called out in American cities. And instead, you had millions upon millions of Americans recognizing the nature of the moment and saying, okay, we are not going to give them what they're asking for. We're going to make sure that these are incredibly passionate but peaceful protests, even a little bit funny and whimsical and clever. I was at the one in DC, and my whole mood was elevated by just the enormous turnout. And then the elections, where it was really gratifying that that so many people saw the threat, saw what was going on. So I know you think, as I do, that one of the sort of disheartening things we saw in Trump 2 is the complete abdication of elites and leaders in standing up to the authoritarian threat, which makes it all the more important as we think about what is the last bulwark, if you don't mind the pun, against this, and it's the voters. And so I would love to hear you on the topic of elections and what Protect Democracy is focused on in terms of threats to free and fair elections going forward. What can ordinary people do? I hear this all the time from viewers and listeners and readers. What can I personally do to ensure that we do have free and fair elections going forward? The last bulwark against authoritarianism.
Well, amen to your recognition that if we survive this moment, which I fundamentally believe we will, it will be because of we the people and not the leaders of institutions who have been woefully disappointing in this moment. But the way we do that, as you know, is through exercising self-government at regular intervals in elections as well as in between. And a couple of ground truths I think that we need to make sure we all are very clear-eyed about, which is Donald Trump, the one time that he lost an election for the presidency and was expected to peacefully transfer power and walk away, refused and tried to use every lever at his disposal to sabotage and subvert the will of the people. So anyone who doesn't anticipate, at least, that he will try to do a version of that again, both in 2026 and in 2028, is ignorant and blind to the facts of history. And so let's just start there. I mean, I had a conversation with the chief of staff to a very sort of mainstream traditionalist leading Republican senator in the lead up to the 2020 election, where I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you about the sort of normal process integrity of the upcoming election? 10 being you're extremely alarmed, 1 being you're not alarmed at all. And he said, Ian, I'm a 0. We are not concerned. And obviously, he was wildly wrong. And yet, I still encounter people who express a similar view of, what are you talking about? You know, he's not going to try anything crazy. And I just find that to be sort of stunningly head in the sand. We know from the data of how he's behaved in the past, he will try to do it. Now, here's the good news. He tried that in 2020 and he failed. He has had allies as part of his movement try wild attempts at election sabotage. I think the most recent dramatic example of this was when Jefferson Griffin, who was a candidate for the state Supreme Court in North Carolina in 2024, lost his election to the incumbent Justice Allison Riggs by about 500 or 600 votes. And Griffin tried to get about 60,000 votes thrown out after the fact by attempting to have the rules changed post hoc from what they were at the time of the election in a way that would have disenfranchised 50 or 60,000 people. He did not argue that he actually won the election under the rules that were in place at the time. He argued that we should change the rules retroactively to throw out a whole bunch of votes. And we were very involved.
There's a legal term for that, Ian. What is that called? Oh,
bullshittery.
We'll go with that.
Bullia shittiest is the Latin, I think. But you know, we were involved in helping to find Griffin's own voters, people who voted for him, whose votes would have been thrown out, so that they could speak publicly in North Carolina and say, I voted for the guy and he wants to cancel my votes. I'm part of a military family living overseas, serving the country, and he wants to throw away votes. And help find former Republican elected officials, former conservative judges on the judiciary there, and ultimately brought a lawsuit that won in federal court, and ultimately the collection of all of those activities and those by many on the ground in North Carolina, many allies in the democracy movement, persuaded Griffin ultimately to concede and stand down. And so I named both the 2020 example and that example because we have been through attempts to sabotage our elections before, and we have been able to hold them strong and make sure that the rightful winners are the ones who took the oath of office and got seated. But in neither of those cases or many other examples that we could talk about, did it happen automatically? Again, like I said about the Constitution, the parchment doesn't do the work. It just gives the people the tools to do the work. And so at Protect Democracy, and I think across the ecosystem, we have to do the work to make sure that the rules that govern the election are honored that the officials who hold core responsibility at the local level don't capitulate to pressure from the White House to bend the rules or corrupt the system, as Trump tried to do, right, by calling Brad Raffensperger in Georgia in 2020 and said, Brad, you just got to find 11,000 votes for me, right? Those officials stood strong in 2020. We got to make sure that they stand strong again. And we got to make sure that the people, ultimately, as you noted, the ultimate bulwark, do two things. One, trust that our elections are reliable, okay? And the people who've had the most doubt in the elections, which are some of Trump's base of voters, all of a sudden believe the elections in 2024 when Trump won. I concede yeah. Trump won in 2024. Right now, about 77%, according to Pew, of Americans believe that elections do result the proper casting of ballots and the will of the people. Trump is going to try over the next couple of months to drive that number down. He wants to persuade people that elections are rife with fraud, which is not true, that foreign interference threatens the national security of our elections. I would not be surprised if Trump was able to coerce leaders in Venezuela or even Nicolas Maduro in sort of a plea negotiation over his criminal proceedings to claim that they actually interfered and stole the 2020 election for Joe Biden. I think he wants to try to figure out how to manufacture evidence of that that doesn't exist. And he's going to try to do that because if he can drive down trust in our electoral system, he can create the patina of justification that his apparatchiks will need around the country to do untoward things to corrupt the system. And so our job is to call the lie on that. That is not true. Every credible investigation into American elections the last 20 years has found that there is no rampant illegal dead voters voting, that the instances of that sort of thing are vanishingly small, and in no way in proportion to actually impact the outcome of an election. So it's extremely, extremely minuscule. And then we need to participate. Not, and this is where we get to your question about what can people do. Obviously, massive participation in elections is key.
Wait. Before we get to that, can I just stop you for 1 second? Because I think your point about he's going to possibly even coerce Maduro into saying something or Delcy Rodriguez. This is brilliant. I mean, amazing anticipation of what could happen. But I guess, what do you think about this? I mean, since you've anticipated it, what would be the best way to head that off? Would be perhaps
we're doing it.
Okay. How?
We're doing it right now. We are doing it right now because this is the lesson about Trump is he's very predictable. So in 2020, it was entirely predictable that because of the pandemic and the distribution of who cast votes on election day and who cast them by mail, that it was likely to be the case that the night of the election, when the election day votes got counted first and they skewed in Trump's favor, that when we all looked at our televisions, it was going to look like Trump is leading 33% of votes counted. Red mirage. And then that was going to change as the mail ballots got counted. And so what did we do? The National Task Force on Election Crises, the Protect Democracy stood up, which is this bipartisan group of leaders that runs the gamut from former Bush Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff to former NAACP LDF director Sherrilyn Ifill, held a dozen press events for, I think it was almost between 800 and 900 reporters, editors, television producers walking through the Red Mirage, and having, informing the news media to be able to explain and educate the American people that we were not going to know the results the night of the election. And that as the mail ballots got counted, it was very possible that the person appearing to lead on your television screen was going to change. And that that was not the sign of some sort of nefarious, corrupt plot. That was just the natural order of the counting of the ballots. And the American people largely came to expect that during 2020. So when Trump did try the Red Mirage and to claim that he had won, people didn't believe him. There were polls taken shortly after he claimed that the 2020 election was stolen. He persuaded about 28 to 32% of the population, according to those polls, consistent with the Pew poll, 77% trust elections. If those numbers hold, if somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the American people trust the elections, and Trump's only going to be able to convince a third, he's not going to be able to steal the election. But if he is able, through manufacturing, you know, Maduro statements, or, you know, the DOJ sent monitors to California and New Jersey in 2024, I predict those monitors are going to come out with reports the next couple of months claiming they found rampant fraud in those places. He's going to try to manufacture a story that our elections can't be trusted, and that is the justification for him and the federal government to assert greater control over elections, because one of the other checks the founders built into our system is that elections are highly decentralized. We don't have one election in this country. We have thousands of local elections. If we had a national election commission the way other countries have, he would take it over the way that he's taking over the FCC. But he can't do that because of the distribution. And so he's going to need to assert some excuse for why either he needs to assert direct control, or why he can coerce local officials by withholding federal funds unless they, quote unquote, clean up their voter rolls and get them to do it. But he's going to need to have a narrative at his back. And if the American people don't buy that narrative, then the officials in local offices who are facing the pressure from the White House will have the people at their backs to say, hogwash, this is BS. The election can be trusted. We're not doing that.
What is your sense of danger regarding potentially ICE or CPB being out in force on the day of the election to drive down turnout in Hispanic neighborhoods and in general to create a sense of lack of safety about voting?
Well, Mona, we should take a minute here to make sure everyone listening really understands what's happening in Minnesota right now. Because I am reading dispatches from on the ground in Minnesota, from people in residential communities who are saying, whatever you are seeing on the news, it is even worse here. Quote unquote, I've seen messages saying, we are under siege. Our police are overwhelmed and feel like they are not in a position to protect us. There are heavily
armed.
There are
way more ICE officers than there are Minneapolis police.
Overwhelming more. Oh, yeah. Yes. There's something like 600 Minneapolis police and several thousand members of federal forces. And these dispatches talk about how on residential streets, there are heavily armed in military fatigues and masks men walking down the street, banging on doors. And in one person explained that when they open the door, the agents there ask them to identify the homes on their street where Asian families lived. Mm. Now, if you've read your World War II history, that is straight out of something that would have happened in Germany or Poland in 1939. Right? Being asked to identify the houses on your street where people of foreign ancestry lived. That is happening in Minnesota right now. These dispatches say that if they ask questions of the federal officials coming down the street or pull out a camera to lawfully video what they're doing, they are getting thrown into banks of ICE forcefully and violently, and there's no recourse. And so people are basically hiding inside. You have schools that are allowing kids to learn remotely. And in some school districts, upwards of 50% of the kids are not coming in because the families are afraid to go outside. And this isn't just people who don't have lawful immigration paperwork. This is U.S. citizens who are terrified because there have been now numerous documented cases of ICE abducting U.S. citizens
absolutely
and holding
right
them in detention. And so your question is absolutely both on point, because this will be a tactic that could potentially be deployed around the election. I think we should expect that they will try it to depress turnout in certain areas. But even prior to the election, our neighbors in this country are experiencing something nightmarish right now. And I think we all who are not currently living through this viscerally in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and in some now rural parts of Minnesota, need to understand that while we are largely going about our normal lives, our fellow residents in Minnesota are living through a dystopian nightmare. And so this is one of the reasons why we brought the lawsuit that I mentioned earlier, why we're getting ready to bring other lawsuits against these conscience-shocking abuses of power, and why the courts need to follow at least the somewhat positive Supreme Court refusal to grant the administration's desire to deploy the National Guard and to crack down even more on not allowing these deployments to deprive people of their constitutional rights, their freedom of movement, and especially their ability to, without fear, go out and cast a ballot in the elections. And I would say this is probably another reason why Trump's going to try to limit mail-in balloting, because if you can't vote by mail and you're forced to go in to vote, then it makes the ability to deploy militarized forces to intimidate and spread fear and stop people from coming out a more effective voter suppression tactic.
Really hard to believe this is America, but this is where we are. Okay. Back to the earlier question, and this is what I would like to close on. And this doesn't have to be short. If it's long, that's great. But like, people want to know, what do I do personally? How do I go about securing, just let's just say for now, the 2026 election is free and fair? What do I do?
PowerThePolls.org. PowerThePolls.org. So this is an organization that started during the pandemic because, as we all will recall, when we went to go vote, oftentimes poll workers tend to be our older neighbors who volunteer, yep, get trained, and do the public service of working the polls. And at the peak of the pandemic, the most vulnerable Americans were our older neighbors. And so during the pandemic, the 2020 election, we lost a lot of poll workers around the country because of very reasonable medical fears of working the polls during the pandemic. And so PowerThePolls.org sprung up to recruit younger poll workers to staff the polls, which is also, pandemic aside, a really important sort of bringing into civic work a new, yes, generation, because a lot of those poll workers had done it for many years, were very trained at how to do it. And we need to make sure that we're carrying on that civic volunteerism. Well, it's not even volunteerism, because poll workers do
they
get
do
paid.
Get paid.
They,
yeah,
do get paid. So it's not volunteerism, but civic public service needs to continue on. And so Power the,
yeah,
Polls,
and they don't get paid that much. I mean, they do deserve full credit for doing this as a civic,
that's right,
duty.
Correct. And we need a whole new generation to sign up and do that. And so one thing that everybody can do, powerthepolls.org, is become a poll worker. Learn it, volunteer, make that civic commitment in this moment. It's the least that we can all do in this civic moment. The second thing I would note is on our website, protectdemocracy.org, if you scroll down on the website, it says, how can you protect democracy? And my colleague Quinn Raymond wrote a wonderful list of 29 different things that you could do. And it's a little bit like a scavenger hunt. He designed it to, like, each week check off one thing and see if you could do one more. And really what it gets to in each of those things are the very basic building blocks of what it is to live in a democracy, a self-governing system, which is you have to become active in your community. You have to be willing to talk about local issues, state issues, sometimes even national issues with your neighbors, and organize people to participate in local processes. Because I think at root, you know, going back to us talking about, maybe if we play our cards right, that this becomes a moment for renewal in this country, that, you know, de Tocqueville talked in Democracy in America about how, yeah, the Constitution is wonderful and all that. But one thing that he really recognized when he came and toured this country was that we had certain what he called habits of the heart that were such a new idea for him to experience coming over from France, of people who lived small d democracy in the way they engaged in their communities, with their neighbors, a sense of agency, a sense of collective work to self-govern. And I think, at least in my lifetime, we've lost a bit of that. We've become slack at our commitment to small d democracy, local engagement, and taking responsibility for setting our own course. And I think that this crisis that we're in is a wake-up call. And what I really like about the list that we have on the website is it is just a how-to, step-by-step guide to re-engage in being an active member of your local civic community in the way that I think is at the fundamental root of our current crisis. And if we all re-engage in that way, I think that is the lifeblood that will refuel the beating heart of American democracy for the era to come, which will probably have elements that you will like that will borrow from what has come before. And we'll probably have new elements that I will like that will be fit the purpose for the 21st century. But the combination of those things, I think, is where we are heading, which is that every crisis in American history has been the precursor to an opportunity. And this one should be no different. We are living through a very frightening and very serious crisis. But if we step up in response as citizens and as fellow Americans and as neighbors, I think we absolutely have the power to shape the future.
Beautifully said. Less beautifully saying it is the T-shirt that my husband has and was wearing the other day that said something like, read history and be reminded that people were always as screwed up as they are now, or something along those lines. But no, it is it does have actually a serious point, though, which is when you read American history, you come away saying, well, you know, we have had our glories, but we have also had our shames and our tragedies, and we have come through some really, really serious things and made ourselves better. And that that renewal has been a part of our history and improvement. And I think that can give us inspiration for whatever comes.
Amen to that.
Thank you so much for joining me, Ian.
Great to see you,
Thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.